Earl Munson. I appear for the plaintiffs below, Curtis John, and with Capital Warehousing. We appeal from a grant of summary judgment in which the district court ruled that a 1997 Federal Communications Administrative Rule made illegal continued payments of a 1986 contract. The judge analyzed a transaction which occurred in 1982 in coming to that conclusion. Below, the defendants also raised issues on summary judgment that they had performed the contract and that the plaintiffs were guilty of laches. Unless the court has questions, I do not intend to deal with those two issues on this appeal. I raise 2 points before the court today. One, that the FCC regulation does not apply to the plaintiffs in any respect. And two, even if it did apply, a refusal to enforce the contract would not advance or preserve the FCC's regulation or the purpose of that regulation in any way. 47 CFR 52.107 is the regulation that we're concerned with. It the district court found that Mr. Yan and Capital Warehousing, as subscribers, were in violation of that regulation by accepting payments. We suggest that Mr. Yan and Capital Warehousing were not subscribers within the definition of that section. The section defines very specifically what a subscriber is. It is, as the court said below, a potential criminal statute. The subscriber is defined as an entity or a person
Has anybody ever asked the FCC concretely for its views on a problem like this?
With respect to the definition of subscriber, no.
Respect to the definition of a subscriber, just with respect to the question whether its regulation deals with the sale of a number that had been assigned at random rather than, say, acquired as part of a warehousing operation. Or otherwise, what the for purpose of sale language in the regulation means.
If I can turn in answering that question to the Patients Plus case, which is a case...
My question is very specific. Okay. Has anyone asked the FCC for its views about what the language means?
We have not, to our knowledge, no one has asked the FCC for its views as to what the language means. What we do know is, under Patients Plus, how the FCC interpreted as they rule on that case. As I indicated, subscriber has a very definite and specific definition. Back in 1982, Mr. Yan was not a subscriber as within that definition. There wasn't any responsible organization. There wasn't any database. There wasn't any request to a responsible organization to reserve a number on the database. Mr. Yan acquired the number in 1976. He acquired it from AT&T. AT&T was then a monopoly. AT&T then took the position that AT&T, owned the number, and that AT&T could control what was done with that number. In 1982, when Mr. Yan transferred the number or assigned it, he assigned it pursuant to the AT&T tariff. That is, he went to AT&T and he said, I want to transfer it to 1-800-FLOWERS, and they gave their consent. There was no requirement that there be a prohibition of a sale. There was no requirement of any kind except that AT&T approved. The collection in 1997 or in 2000 when the district court ruled, obviously Mr. Yan and Capital Warehousing were not subscribers. The number hadn't been a subscriber since 1982. They were not then subject to either the regulation or to the tariffs under which 800 numbers are given.
What was the language of the tariff at the time the number was assigned?
At the time the number was assigned, the tariff said, in effect, that the number could be assigned by a subscriber.
I don't like in effect. I'm interested in what the actual language of the tariff was, not what your interpretation of the language of the tariff was.
Yes, sir. The tariff is that we have in the record is one from 1984, and it deals only with the assignment of the number and the criteria that AT&T put out.
Perhaps you could just give me a citation to where I can find it in the record, and then I can get the exact language.
Sir, it is Mr. Miller's affidavit. And
we'll
I don't
find
have
it.
That. I don't have that. Well, it's Miller's
perhaps
affidavit.
When you come back on rebuttal, you can give me a precise citation to where I can find the language from 84 or 86.
I will, sir.
Thank you.
In addition, back in 1982, we suggested Mr. Yan and Capital Warehousing did not sell the number for a fee. Assume that in that time, Mr. Yan had formed a corporation, 1-800-356-9377, Inc. That's the number. Formed that corporation, and he transferred the number to that corporation. So now he's got a corporation, 1-800-356-9377, Inc., with a number. He also formed another corporation, 1-800-Flowers, Inc. I suggest to you that neither corporation is worth a dime. That is, the number in the hands of 1-800-356-9377, Inc. isn't worth anything. 1-800-Flowers has no value because it doesn't have the number. Put them together, and Mr. Yan has created value. Put them together, and Mr. Yan has put together a concept for the marketing of flowers throughout the country for telephone purposes. Mr. Yan did exactly that. That is, he formed the corporation in 1981, 1-800-Flowers. In May of 1982, he transferred the number to 1-800-Flowers, a corporation he controlled. No money was exchanged hands. He received, as I said, the consent of AT&T to that transfer. In the summer of 1992, after that transfer, Mr. Yan joined with Mr. Simmons and Mr. Snow for a test run of the project down in New Orleans. It was highly successful. They sold flowers, they took orders, and they were encouraged that their marketing plan was right. Unfortunately, that triggered a lawsuit, and Mr. Simmons and Mr. Snow and Mr. Yan and Capital Warehousing couldn't afford to defend that lawsuit. Mr. Alexander was the source of money, and Mr. Alexander joined, and the four gentlemen, none of whom had any experience with marketing flowers in the past, the four gentlemen formed this corporation and formed their business plan. Did the transfer of the number to 1-800-Flowers play a part in this business plan? Of course it did. But it was the transfer of the number as a part of a transaction which was a part of a business joint venture by the parties. It is here that I turn to Patients Plus case. The Patients Plus case was a case filed before the Federal Communications Commission prior to April 1997 when the regulation was adopted, but decided by the deputy chief after the regulation, but in 1997. Mr. Goodman, the complainant in that case, said that he applied for the number 1-800-JUSTICE, and the responsible organization tried to hold him up. That is, they tried to get money from him in return for that number. He said to the FCC, that's wrong. You ought to give me the number, and you ought to give me damages. The deputy chief said, noted first, that these two parties were engaged in a proposed joint venture for the marketing of the 1-800-JUSTICE number. Then the deputy chief said, thus, even if we were to accept that Tina Johnson demanded $1,500, now that's $1,500 per month, per area code, for the number, even though she made that demand, said the deputy chief, as a counteroffer to Goodman's proposal, we would find that it was in the context of the proposed joint venture rather than merely for the assignment of the 1-800-JUSTICE number. Merely for the assignment of the 1-800-JUSTICE number. I suggest that the FCC, in passing its rule, no hoarding, no brokering, no selling for a fee, meant just that, brokering, that is, acquiring numbers, one or more, for the specific purpose of selling that number and creating a market for numbers in and of itself. It did not intend to prohibit the creation of business or the transfer of business, just as Mr. Yan had done. in 1982. Now, the district court in her ruling agreed that the transaction in 1982 was not a charade. This was a legitimate business transaction. Mr. Yan did give up control. Mr. Alexander did obtain control of 1-800-Flowers. She agreed that this was a business in which their plan was to market these flowers, as now has been done over 20 years. But she said, the royalty was paid at least in part because of the assignment of the number. But that's not what the FCC seemed to say in the Patients Plus case. It couldn't be just in part. If it was in part as a part of a transaction, a joint venture, that was permissible. The defendants here seem to agree
with... What did Mr. John have to contribute other than that to this 82 venture?
Well, he had business acumen to contribute. He had the number. He had the corporation, the 1-800-Flowers Corporation, and he gave up control of that corporation after the number and the corporation were put together.
What were the assets other than the number?
Not much. On the other hand, if I might say, sir, none of these four gentlemen had any experience in the flower business. Senator Snow didn't have any business in the flower business. Alexander didn't. These were four gentlemen who had an idea. That's the American way. That is what makes this free enterprise system operate, with people with new ideas, new ventures, taking risks in order to create a new business.
Not to dismiss that argument in any fashion, but my focus and concern at this time is on the Texas law issue.
The Texas law issue?
Yes, and how do you mount a challenge to the law of Texas under which this contract is governed?
The defendants now agree that this agreement should be construed according to the law of the state of Wisconsin, but the district court did cite to the Centex case.
Yes, it did.
She cited to section 261 and 264 of the restatement, which in turn are statements of the Centex rule. And I suggest, Your Honor, that those two sections and the Centex case have absolutely no bearing on this case. Section 261 and 264 are designed for a promisor, in this case 1-800-Flowers, to come to a court and say, court, if I perform this contract, I'm going to be punished or have something bad happen to me because I'm in violation of the law. On the other hand, if I don't perform this contract, I am now in violation of the contract. Section 261 and 264 say then that the promisor can come to the court and say, I'm between a rock and a hard place, and I should have relief. But here, 1-800-Flowers isn't between a rock and a hard place. There is no restriction on 1-800-Flowers making payments under this contract. This regulation that the court relied upon was a regulation which governed the seller of a number. That is, no person shall broker, sell numbers. It also contained a regulation. The regulation contained a prohibition that no person shall buy or acquire a number for the express purpose of selling it for a fee. No one suggests that 1-800-Flowers had acquired this number for the purpose of selling it for a fee. 1-800-Flowers, 1-800-Flowers, the defendants here, were not even parties to the transaction back in 1982. What that means then is that there is no regulation here in which 1-800-Flowers can come to a court and say, I'm caught between a rock and a hard place, because they're not. Making the payments under the contract does not in any way violate the regulation. I suggest, Your Honor, that the district court got off on the wrong foot by citing 261 and 264 because they don't apply. We don't use those numbers in order to determine whether or not there's illegality. Those sections assume there is illegality of some sort. What the court should have done was look at a section 178 of the restatement. That's the issue. And under 178, and under cases such as Carbon County, which this court decided, the issue is whether the court should balance the interest. We have an interest in the sanctity of contracts. And the question becomes whether the sanctity of contract is clearly outweighed by the enforcement of, by a policy of the FCC. Here, this policy, this regulation was adopted by the FCC because of the rapid and unanticipated depletion of a limited resource. That policy has not furthered in any way, shape, or manner by the refusal to enforce this contract. If the court has no questions, I'll have reserved time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Munson. Mr. Conley.
May it please the court, I am Bill Conley of the law firm of Foley and Lardner. We represent the defendant 800 Flowers, Inc., which is the current user of the 1-800-356-9377 number, the 800 Flowers number that is the subject of this lawsuit. And we also represent the other defendants, 800flowers.com, and Fresh Intellectual Property. With me today is the Senior Vice President of the principal defendant, 800 Flowers, Jerry Gallagher, and also the CFO, Bill Shea. The fundamental flaw in plaintiff's argument is that it fails to acknowledge that the ownership of a toll-free number has been prohibited from the time it was assigned to the plaintiffs here, back in 1976, and throughout the
term. I don't understand what the significance of that is.
The significance
people often sell or dispose of things they don't own. If you own a piece of software, for example, and you read the packaging carefully, you'll discover that all you have is a license to use it. But people routinely sell pieces of software.
Well,
and one couldn't defend against a suit for payment on the ground that all they had was a license to use it.
Whether or not their license restricts resale, Your Honor, would be an issue.
It's a question different from ownership.
I agree with you.
That's why the proposition that there is no ownership interest in the number does not prevent a transfer of whatever interest the subscriber had.
And if we were dealing simply with the express prohibition and you had no other guidance from the FCC, I think this would be a closer question. Perhaps Your Honor would be correct as to its resolution. But we're not. We're dealing with the history under the FCC's articulation that date back well before even the 1997 regulation, which spelled out that there could be no sale. Indeed, the FCC spelled out in tariffs back to 1993.
Wait. Tariffs are not created by the FCC. Tariffs are created by the carriers who file with the FCC. They're private documents. That's why I asked your adversary, what did the tariff in force at the time of the transfer provide?
And the answer to that, Your Honor, is, and you can find it in the Miller affidavit, which was filed in support of summary judgment.
Could you give me a record citation to this?
I don't have the record citation, Your Honor, but it would be easily found in the docket numbers right next to the motion for summary judgment by the defendant. Miller affidavit in support of summary judgment, Exhibit A. And that includes a series of tariffs which date back to, as Mr. Munson represented the court, back to 1984, though there's every reason to believe that those tariffs continued to be filed by AT&T prior to that time. And indeed, the plaintiffs acknowledged that they were aware of the prohibition of ownership, the denial of ownership in the tariffs even
now,
at the
time of the building. I want to keep two things separate.
Right.
One is whether there is private ownership in a number. And the second is the question whether whatever interest the subscriber has can be sold. I'm interested in what the tariff says about the latter. Now, is what you're referring me to in Exhibit A to the Miller affidavit going to deal with the latter, or is it just a statement about we, AT&T, own these numbers?
It is a statement that under this tariff the customer does not have a proprietary interest, does not own the number.
But that's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in what the tariff says, if anything. Maybe it says nothing. What the tariff says, if anything, about transactions in numbers.
I understand, Your Honor. And the first time that that was articulated was in a tariff in 1993, which expressly stated that there is a prohibition.
But it's apparent in 1993 obviously doesn't affect an earlier transaction. What a tariff in 1993 would do is interesting. We would then have to raise the question whether a tariff between, say, AT&T and the subscriber affects transactions between a subscriber and a third party. But I don't see how a tariff in 1993 does anything about a transaction in the 1980s.
Well, as the first point, the tariff is law. It is approved by the, it's filed with the FCC.
The tariff is a statement of the rules on which the telephone company does business. And under the filed tariff doctrine, the telephone company cannot do business on any other basis. But it is not law.
As the force of law is between AT&T and the FCC, Your Honor. But the FCC...
No, it does not. The FCC can change tariffs.
Well,
there's no force of law other than the filed tariff doctrine, which affects how the tariff filer must deal with a private party. But to say it's the same thing as a federal regulation is not a correct statement of what a tariff is.
And if I made that statement, then I apologize, Your Honor. If I think the real point is that the tariff does give guidance both to AT&T and to its subscribers, ultimately other responsible organizations and their subscribers, as to the nature of the ownership and the proper use of the number. Further, the FCC has gone on to explain that the original prohibition, which they recognize a longstanding prohibition against ownership, prohibits the sale of a number. Contrary to what has been suggested by Mr. Munson, the Pensions Plus case actually stands for that very proposition. They said, although some of the policies, including brokering of numbers, may have only recently been enunciated by the Commission, they reflect the longstanding Commission policy that toll-free numbers are a public resource that is not the property of either the carrier or the subscriber. And to that extent, it is the...
Counsel, you keep coming back to this statement, not the property. But since it is clear that one can sell an interest in something, even though you don't have a property interest in it, that's why I can sell my copy of Microsoft Office to somebody else, even though the license agreement makes it clear that it's Microsoft's property. It's also clear that I can sell it, and whoever I sell it to has to pay me for it. So I don't understand why you keep coming back to this statement, no property interest in the number.
Well, with respect, Your Honor,
if AT&T cancels the number 1-800-FLOWERS tomorrow, the statement no property interest means that your client can't sue them.
I'm not sure that
doesn't mean any more than that. So far,
well, actually, Your Honor, I'm not sure that that point is correct. I think if AT&T or another restaurant were to cancel,
so you think you have a real protectable interest in the number, even though there's no property interest.
In all candor to the court, that is the recognized rule by the FCC. But Your Honor, at least by 1997, you can't sell a number. That's a direct prohibition in 1997. In fact, that is what the court concluded.
Where is this prohibition?
Toll-free subscribers shall not hoard toll-free numbers, and that includes brokering a number, which is the selling of a toll-free number by a private entity for free.
There's actually a definition in the regulation.
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
Defines hoarding as acquiring a number for the purpose of sale.
Right.
In your view, who acquired a number for the purpose of sale here?
Your Honor, that is not... There are two prohibitions. You're looking at the latter, which is B. The former, sub A, says toll-free subscribers...
No, I was quoting from A.
Well, I think you're quoting from the definition under
B requires every carrier to put in a tariff the FCC's statement that numbers shouldn't be sold. There's one reason why I keep coming back to what's actually in these tariffs. Sub B is more helpful to you than sub A.
Your Honor, I think the prohibition is found in both places. But not to belabor the point, you're right. The tariff in sub B expressly states that there shall be no sales of toll-free numbers by private entities for a fee. So as it's the time that those tariffs were in place, which, as I say, dates back to 1993, but certainly is in place by regulation by the FCC in 1997, there is no longer any ambiguity. You may not sell a toll-free number. Now,
I guess I'll give up. The rule doesn't say that. Sub A says you can't hoard a number, which is defined as acquiring a number for the purpose of sale. And you haven't told me who was hoarding a number within that definition.
Well, Your Honor, the definition...
B is not a requirement binding on private parties. It's a direction about what has to be in tariffs. And it leads me, as I keep saying, to ask, what was concretely in the tariffs?
For the record, just so we're clear, I don't think you're accurately reflecting A, but I understand the court reads it differently, because A goes on to say that the hoarding is not just buying for resale, but is brokering, which is the sale of a toll-free number by a private entity for a fee. I think that's an express prohibition. Secondly, even if the court weren't to agree with that, the tariff is an express prohibition, and even if the court believes that the tariff is not binding on private parties, it certainly is a statement of policy. And while the district court found it that there was an express prohibition in the 97 regulation, this court has the power, as the court did in Centex, as the Supreme Court has in Motley and other cases, to find as a matter of policy that there is a prohibition evidenced by the FCC. And we think that policy is vindicated, has to be vindicated here, against the value in a number. That longstanding policy is one which is reflected both in the Patients Plus case that I quoted and also in the letter to Weiss, which Patients Plus dates back to 91. The Weiss letter dates back to 1996. And again, in Weiss, the FCC said that, in this case, a responsible organization's attempt to negotiate the transfer of a toll-free number for a profit is contrary to the longstanding policy of the Commission prohibiting the establishment of ownership interest in toll-free numbers. Again, linking the original prohibition against ownership in numbers, which dates back to the very beginning of the relationship which Mr. Yon and Capital Warehousing had with AT&T, to the prohibition against sale. And if you look further behind the policy that is being enforced here, the prohibition against sale, the longstanding prohibition against ownership, and the further articulated prohibition now against ownership has at least three important aspects to it that the FCC is recognizing. One is that by permitting the sale of a number, you're essentially acknowledging an ownership interest. The second is that, and in the letter to Weiss, the court actually said, the second is that you are providing an incentive to brokering, or in other words, by permitting brokering, even the sale of a single
number. If your law firm merges with another law firm, forms a new entity, do you think you can transfer to that new entity your current telephone number so that when your old clients call, they will get the new partnership?
Absolutely not.
Why isn't that, in your view, number brokering? Because your existing law firm has sold, transferred, given for value, whatever, its number to some other entity.
Two distinctions. Since 1997, you can't sell the number. You can condition a sale of a business on approved transfer by the FCC, but you couldn't sell it since 1997. There's an express prohibition against sale. You couldn't have sold it before that time, in our view, under the tariff. But, Your Honor, to further answer your question,
this sounds like semantic quibbling.
Well,
any normal person would call that transaction a sale, just like the sale of the furniture. It's been transferred for value to a new owner.
I think there are two distinctions. One is that one is an express sale, a naked sale of a number, and that's a distinction with a difference to the FTC. They don't want to create value in or a market for numbers per se. The second distinction Your Honor has drawn is you've posited a situation where you are selling a business. As Judge Crabb found, and as the facts show here, this wasn't the sale of a business, this was a naked sale of a number. And I suggest to you that the important distinction between transfer conditioned, approved transfer conditioned on sale, and a sale of a number is that it helps draw the distinction between the payment for the value of the business, the equity that they built up in
the
business, and the alternative.
Suppose in the transaction I have given you, all the assets of the firm are acquired, including the telephone number, the furniture, and the office space. And the furniture and the office space are then sold. Has that now become unlawful because all that's been retained by the acquiring firm is the telephone numbers?
Your Honor, I mean, the other thing that has been retained is the goodwill of the company. and I think it can be allocated.
Goodwill is embedded in the telephone number.
But, Your Honor, my reading of the regulation is if all you had, if you, to take your analogy further, if all you had left, you sold off the trademark, you know, Foley & Lardner or Sidley & Austin, and all of the business, all of the employees, everything else had been sold.
To make it more concrete, make it Usham, Lincoln, and Beal,
right,
which did this, by the way.
Well,
sold essentially everything but the phone numbers.
Well, and the goodwill of the company. But
there was nothing to the goodwill except the phone numbers after they were done.
Well, I hope that's not true, Your Honor, but that may have been your perception.
In your position, Scali, the only thing you could do in the kind of transaction that Judge Easterbrook has posited is in an agreement to either merge or sell, is to promise to make application to the FCC. That's the only thing you have to sell. Is that your position? The assignment, you'll ask the FCC to continue the assignment to the new entity.
Right.
And you have nothing else to commit to in the bargain. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, Your Honor. You don't have the ability to sell the number itself. But you could certainly agree to cooperate in the transfer of the number subject to the FCC.
You can make it a condition of the sale that you'll mm-hmm. perform that, right?
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think that's an important distinction because it is a distinction as to the value. Take it a step further, Your Honor. The problem with assigning numbers is probably no more starkly presented than in this case, because what they negotiated was not even the sale of the number for a price. They negotiated an ongoing perpetual royalty. A rest org, AT&T, MCI, anyone else, could not have done what they did, which was to assign a value to the use of the number instead of to the service being offered. They essentially have assigned an additional price, an additional charge. Not essentially, they have a surcharge based on the value of the phone number rather than the value of the service provided. That is not a reasonable rate for AT&T or for MCI or anyone else.
AT&T isn't charging it. If you come back to my Isham, Lincoln, and Beal example,
right,
if somebody puts down when that firm's assets are being acquired by whoever scavenged their assets, X dollars for the library, Y dollars for the value of the lease, Z dollars for the furniture, right, and Q dollars for the phone numbers, those dollars are paid, right, and then they go sell the library, and they sell the lease, and they sell the furniture. The dollars are paid. In your view, do they have to be paid back because there's actually this notation in the agreement of sale that when we're apportioning money, we're apportioning X dollars to the phone number?
When you're talking about allocation or undoing an existing contract, I'm not sure how it would be resolved, Your Honor. But to make the, you know, drawing the distinction between, well, the subscriber and AT&T.
If you don't say that it has to be undone, right, then you're in the position of saying that although phone numbers can be sold, they have to be sold for a lump sum and not a royalty.
Right, and I'm not saying
even though, of course, any royalty can be restated as a lump sum in the reverse.
And I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm saying that as to a rest org, like the one in TRW, insisting on a price over and above the value of the service, that is void, and the FCC has made it void. Similarly, the FCC has said a subscriber cannot usurp a value or a price for the number itself. That's the prohibition. And so in those cases, it would have to be undone, yes.
What's the value of the service to the consumer? I mean, the service is not rendered by the consumer, right? It's rendered by the provider.
In other words, providing the 800 number?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's right, Your Honor. The charge, though, that we're talking about is a charge on the use of a number. That's why this perpetual royalty makes it even more extreme than a single payment, because it grows an ongoing basis.
Assuming this is the policy of the FCC, we should accept it just because they've declared it the policy. They just don't want a lottery win. Is that what this is all about?
I think it is, and certainly that's with Judge Crabb's view, that we have it's articulated a policy. The FCC has exclusive jurisdiction over it.
What's the sense behind the policy? Well, if we were sitting around at the end, if we were all commissioners, why would we have this policy? How does it aid the public good?
The most clearly articulated reason, which was done in the second report at the time they enacted the 1997 prohibition, the regulation expressly prohibiting, was that they couldn't regulate or they couldn't control how these numbers would be used once they were released. you're talking about 8 million numbers.
Right.
So unlike a more discrete...
Well, why would they need to control it, I guess? What's the underlying need to retain...
If they create a market for numbers, there's going to be hoarding of numbers. And that's what they expressly prohibited. And then they went on to prohibit the brokering of numbers, the single sale.
Well, I understand why they did it, but what fear is there? What does hoarding do? Is it just takes it off the table?
Right.
I mean, there aren't enough numbers?
It does two things. One is and this happened at the time that they released the 800 numbers. It happened again in attempts when they released the 888 numbers. There were individuals who tried to glom on to as many 800 numbers that they could and then sell them off, which created just to complete my answer, Your Honor. One is that created scarcity, and the second is it created a price for 800 numbers over and above the service, which is exactly what the FCC said. They wanted to ensure, and in fact are charged by Congress with ensuring, the free use and allocation, free allocation and use of toll-free numbers. And that's what they were concerned about, scarcity and a surcharge, which is the same thing we're faced with here.
Let me ask a version of the Chief Judge's question. Why is it that there is a free market in Internet domain addresses but not in telephone numbers when they are fundamentally the same thing?
Because the FCC has established that they want to control...
Is there any sense behind your submission that there is a perfectly free market in domain addresses but not in telephone numbers?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the domain market, it wasn't a regulated industry, but getting to your point as to the sense behind that, the Internet, the potential numbers, the potential names and uniqueness is almost insurmountable, whereas you were dealing with 8,800,000 numbers and 8,888 numbers.
True. The total number of numbers in the number system, in the number table for domain names, is essentially identical to the number in the number table for telephone numbers. If you look at an IP address, it's got, I think, not either 9 or 10 numbers in it, just like a phone number.
Well, it may be, Your Honor, that ultimately there will be a decision made that there is sufficient scarcity of domain names that the court, that Congress will have to regulate those as well, because we are inhibiting commerce. But there's no question that Congress and the FCC had concluded that there is a scarcity in 800 numbers and now 888 numbers, and that needed to be regulated. The free use and allocation of those numbers needed to be regulated by the FCC. Thank you for your
time. Thank you, Mr. Conley. Mr. Monson.
The record page is record, excuse me, sir, is record 59, Exhibit A. The tariff that is referred to at that page deals primarily with the transfer of the number, and it does say that the tariff, it does not give the customer or add any or transfer any interest or proprietary right in the number itself. There is also at record 62, Exhibit 309, a copy of the transaction that occurred in May of 1982 when the number was assigned by Mr. Yan to and Capital Warehousing to 1-800-FLOWERS. And in addition, that's a bill of sale also for October of 1982. It was a bill of sale in order to make the corporate record straight. Court, please. Mr. Conley indicates that the issue here is whether it concedes that the only question with respect to the FCC rule is that it prohibits the naked sale, the brokering of a number for itself. Again, I repeat what I said at my opening, that is that the district court didn't find that there was that. She said that this was a legitimate transaction, a business transaction, but she said the assignment was at least in part for the purpose of transferring the number. The district court's ruling creates what I suggest is an unworkable rule. There are millions of these numbers out there. There are millions of these numbers being used by businesses.
Is there any indication in any case where a sale has occurred of a number that there was anything, I mean, one of the cases that you could cite to us, that there is any significant asset other than a number, Mr. Munson, in any case that you've found?
No, sir. I've never found any sale, any case.
So what crisis has Judge Crabb created by this ruling that you suggest?
Well, I think she's created a real crisis, sir.
Yeah.
That is, what she has said is that a district court, when a promisor, 1-800-Flowers, wants to not perform under a continuing obligation to pay, that she may then dig back to 1982 to determine whether there was some value attributed to the number in that transaction. But there are going to be thousands, literally hundreds of thousands of transactions where businesses are transferred.
Well, let's leave her analysis aside for just a second, respectfully, and let's assume that the FCC and its infinite wisdom or lack thereof has the power to do what it's done, and we are going to defer to it, just assuming arguendo.
Yes, sir.
So now I want you to tell me why this contract is going to survive the Texas law application that may apply here. Why doesn't Texas law control this issue?
Because this is a federal issue, and it is determined under federal law. That is the application of a federal regulation to a contract.
I understand it. But you want to enforce a contract here, right?
I want to.
Yeah, the contract was drafted under the laws of Texas.
It was drafted, and the contract says that it shall be interpreted under the law of Texas.
Right. So why should we deviate from that language of the contract?
Because this course has held that when we're dealing with a federal regulation and the effect of a federal regulation on the contract under the illegality issue, that we apply federal law.
Well, federal law to what? To interpret the contract?
Federal law to determine whether or not a contract should or should not be enforced under the illegality doctrine. That's the federal issue. And there the court sort of said that we balance the pros and the cons. We look to the purpose of the FCC rule. And the purpose of the FCC rule was to stop the bleeding, the decline of a resource.
So the FCC says it's against public policy to be involved in what we'll call the transfer, let's say, of these numbers for compensation. And Texas law says if it violates public policy, then that'll relate back, will it not, to the contract?
No, we still balance the interest as to whether or not enforceability of that contract should be prohibited by the court. My time is up.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Munson. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.